Hey, good morning. Mazel tov to all those who are at the bris. And I want to start off with a story that Boaz told me yesterday. So Boaz said that he was one time doing a deal in diamonds with a person who wasn't religious, and the person wanted the diamonds on credit. And Boaz asked him, you know, for interest over the month, that the money wouldn't be paid. And the guy was surprised because he knew that religious people were not allowed to lend money with interest. And even if it's Derech Nechachumemkar, right, I guess this guy was a bit of a lamdun, but even if it's Derech Nechachumemkar, meaning I'm giving you merchandise and you're giving me money, right, but that still is Asur Midrabanan to take interest. And so he said, how can a religious Jew take interest on this money? And Boaz says, well, there's such a thing as a heter iska, that we transform this this loan into a business partnership, and thereby that enables us to collect interest. And the guy was very, very surprised, and he said, you know, if you live 10 miles away from shul, or if the rabbi lived, 10 miles away from shul, would you come up with some sort of a mumbo jumbo, right, to allow the rabbi to drive to shul? Obviously not. So, like, what are you doing here, right, coming up with a mumbo jumbo to justify, taking interest for these 3 months? So this is an example of the potentially corrosive impact that haramos can have, right, both on a person's connection to Torah mitzvos and on the image which Orthodox religious Jews project to the world at large. And so it's important when we're studying the topic of harama to put it in its proper hashkafic framework. In other words, we don't take advantage of haramos whenever the opportunity presents itself. Haramos are there for a very narrow and specific purpose, and we're only supposed to take advantage of haramos or permit people to use haramos when the narrow criteria that are necessary are met. And I'll introduce this with a Dvar Torah, which I've said here in the past, but which I think is one of the most important Dvar Torah that I know of in existence. And it's based on the words Lifnim Mishuras Hadin. In English, usually we translate Lifnim Mishuras Hadin as what's the English expression for Lifnim Mishuras Hadin? It's beyond the letter of the law. And we don't usually pay attention to the fact that that these expressions actually create a certain visual imagery. So the expression in English, beyond, right, the letter of the law, makes it sound, right, like I'm over here, right, and the letter of the law is over here, and when I go beyond the letter of the law, so I'm going past, right, almost as if, right, it starts out being my comfort zone, right, and then there's the letter of the law which takes me to the edge of my comfort zone, and then going beyond the letter of the law is taking me even, outside of my comfort zone, such that the law itself is pulling me away, right, from where I want to be in life, and going beyond the letter of the law is pulling me far, far away from the purpose of life, which is, according to the Declaration of Independence, right, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Right, so beyond the letter of the law is pulling me away from my pursuit of happiness. But the Hebrew imagery of Lifnim Mishuras Hadin actually tells a very different story. The story of Lifnim Mishuras Hadin is told really mainly in the first word, which is Lifnim. It's not beyond, right, taking me outside, but it's inside. A shura, right, it means a line or a wall, right, as in Banot Tsa'ada Ali Shur, that talks about Yosef, and there was a parade in Egypt, and all the girls lined up, right, on the walls, right, to witness the parade. Banot Tsa'ada Ali Shur, Shur, Shura is a wall, right, or a line that delineates and demarcates between, right, one zone and another zone. And of course, you have Din. And so the imagery over here is that Din is a wall. Right, it's not just a letter, right? It's a wall. And Rav Shlomo Valbi in his Sefer Ali Shur explains that the idea is that life, right, is like a jungle, or life is like a desert. I prefer the desert imagery. I always think of Dr. Seuss's Lorax book, where the Onceler is traveling, through the desert, right, and suddenly he happens upon, right, this beautiful oasis, which is populated by swami swans and truffula trees and all sorts of delightful things. And when you come upon an oasis, and you want to build a civilization and a settlement in the oasis, one of the important things to do is to build a wall around the oasis. And that's for two reasons. The first reason is because outside there's wild animals, there's bandits, and you don't want them to come and prey upon the civilization and the town that you're building. And so you build the wall to keep them out. The second reason is because kids, and sometimes even enterprising or unsuspecting grown-ups tend to wander, and you want to make sure that they stay within the safe zone, that they don't wander beyond into the area which is unsafe and where they potentially jeopardize their health and their safety. And so you build the wall in order to make sure that people know this is the limit, right, beyond which there's danger. Inside is safe and outside there's danger. That's the idea of calling din, right, or halacha, a shura. We call it a wall because the purpose of din is to delineate the absolute outer limits, right, where it's still safe, spiritually safe, the outer limits of conduct, which are spiritually safe. And if you just follow along with this parallel, so there are some people who are called ma'amid divrehem al din Torah, which means people who insist that they're only going to do what the law requires of them and no more. So if you take again this desert imagery, these are people, they build their house right next to the wall, on the inside of the wall, of course, because they wouldn't ever step outside the wall. They're on the inside of the wall. They take care of all their business, all their strolls that are right next to the wall. But the result of that is, if you just think about this oasis, and where is all of the greenery? And where is all of the music of the birds? Where are all of the colorful flowers? They're at the center, right? Because that's where the water is. The wall is in the most desolate area of the oasis. It's in the area which is closest to the desert and furthest from the source of water. And so a person who builds his house and spends most of his time next to the wall, who's ma'amid divarav al din Torah, is basically going to end up living a very bleak and colorless and unpleasant existence. The only way to find the real beauty in this oasis, the real center where everything is to head away from the wall and go further inward, towards the source of the water where everything, really, where the life, and the beauty comes from. And that's the idea of lifnim, right, mishuras hadin, the imagery, right, that this creates is telling you that if you live your life, right, solely hugging the wall, then you're going to end up having a life which is, not the most spiritually beautiful and uplifting and fulfilling. And the only real way to find that fulfillment and that uplift is to go further inwards, is to go a little bit beyond, right, but not in this beyond, but further in from the letter of the law, because that's where you can find all of the beauty. So there definitely are some people, right, nowadays we don't call it, hugging the wall, but what we call it is looking at halacha as an obstacle course. The goal of life, right, is to be comfortable. The goal of life is to be accepted or to live up to the standards, right, which are set, by and large by the Gentile, society around us. Just that, as a religious Jew, right, I need to keep halacha. And so halacha says I can't do this and I can't do that and I can't do the other thing. And at certain times I have to do these things. So I'll do all these things. That's my token contribution to my Jewish identity. But I'm going to spend most of my life pursuing the ideals of the Western society that surrounds me. And that's an idea of ma'amid divarav al din Torah. I'm going to do the minimum, right, that the law requires me. But ultimately the goal of my existence, right, is the same as the goal of my guys and neighbors in their existences. The other perspective is a perspective that says, no, that mitzvot are a gift. Mitzvot allow me to rise above, right, all of these failures that beset contemporary Western society and to find something redeeming in life, to find something that really helps me discover myself, discover my relationship with other people, and most importantly, discover my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and nourish it and develop it and help it grow. And that's the perspective of going lifnim mishuras hadin. So obviously, depending on which perspective you take, you're going to take a very different attitude towards haramos. The person who says that the goal of life is comfort, right, will obviously want to take advantage of haramos as much as possible. And the question is that obviously that's not the role that Chazal envisioned, right, when they propagated and opened up these loopholes for people to take advantage of. And so the question is, why did they include these loopholes in the legal system to begin with? Right? They could have. They obviously were aware of the existence of these loopholes. They're included in the Gemara. Why didn't they close the loopholes? Right? We talk about, you know, tax loopholes, and why aren't those closed? And it's because of lobbying and whatever else. But Chazal were not vulnerable to the pressures of lobbyists. Right? And so if they left the loophole, obviously there was a spiritual reason, right, why this loophole was important as well.
So my question is, the Torah says something, where do you go around it? What did you make it the way the Torah said? Black and white.
So I'll tell you what I think. Let me just introduce it. Let me introduce it with a story. I was really thinking a lot about this last night. And I remember the story, a children's story, which probably comes from a medrash that I read many years ago. And the story is about a chassid echad, right, a very religious person. And one time he was taking a stroll on Shabbat, and he passed by his orchard, and he noticed that there was a hole in the fence of his orchard. It was big enough to allow thieves, right, or animals to get into the orchard and to ruin, right, all of his grapes. And immediately he started planning, right, about, you know, which contractor he was going to call after Shabbos, you know, to fix the hole, and, you know, what, you know, instructions he would give him, and should he knock down the whole fence and replace it, or should he just, you know, patch up the hole, and what's better aesthetically, and what's better for safety. And then he suddenly realized it's Shabbos. And these thoughts are not Shabbosic thoughts. And at the moment he made a vow, he's never going to patch up the hole in the fence ever again, because he had these non-Shabbistic thoughts, right? He had already planned everything out. He did not want to take advantage, right, of these plans. He didn't want to benefit, right, from this non-Shabbistic thought that he had on Shabbos. And so he took a neder that he's never going to repair this hole at all. And the end of the story ended up very beautifully, right, where a special tree, a slach tree, grew up, you know, in the hole, and it blacked the hole, and the slach tree has all sorts of delicious little fruits, you know, that come at, you know, one for each season, and, you know, he was set for life. But, you know, it's an interesting thing, because in Zeros, right, we say that you're allowed to think about non-Shabbistic things on Shabbos. And how does it go? I don't remember the end of it. Hirhurim mutarim. Right, with the Shadei Chabanos. How did it start off? That particular stanza. Hiluchach te benachas unet kol haShabbos. Nashino mishubachas kedas nefesh mishivas b'chi nafshi b'cha orga v'layuach b'chibas. Kashoshan suga bol yuchu beinu bas. That's afterwards, I think. Friday night or is it daytime?
Friday night.
So here we are. Chafatzecha bo asurim. Right. This demer has a lot of halachos in it. Chafatzecha bo asurim. Right. Pursuit of your desires. Right. Are not allowed on Shabbos if that involves some sort of malacha or talking about malacha. Right. Begam lachshov cheshbonos. Also to make business calculations, bookkeeping, accounting. Right. That's not allowed on Shabbos. Again, if that's being done, right, verbally or maybe even just reading an accounting, you know, ledger. However, herhurim mutarim. You're allowed to think, right, about non-Shabbistic things. The Shadei Chabanos. So you're also allowed, right, you know, to run after, right, if you want a girl to marry, you can try to woo her on Shabbos. The Tinok Lando Sefer, you can make deals about children's tuition, right, on Shabbos. If you happen to meet the administrator, executive director, right, of the yeshiva, so you can talk about, you know, tuition payments, especially if you want to increase them. And and of course the main thing is, right, that you should study Torah, Bechal, Pinos, Machanos, right, wherever you happen to be found. And so the idea here is, Hirhurim, right, Mutarim, you're allowed to think non-Shabbistic thoughts on Shabbos. So why was this chassid so upset? It wasn't as if he transgressed a halakha by planning in his head whom he was going to call and what instructions he was going to give. And the answer to that is that there are many, many different levels when it comes to Shmirah Shabbos. There's the level where you're basically just doing what the din requires of you, in which case you'll get, you know, the minimum that's available from Shabbos. And then there's the lifnim mishuras hadin, when a person really wants to go to the inner essence and the beauty and the vitality of Shabbos, and that requires sometimes going a little bit beyond the letter of the law. That's good. It looks, you know, requires going a little bit beyond the letter of the law. Cheesecake. Wow. So. Ah, very apropos. So again, when a person has this, you know, this higher level, really wanting to tap in and get the most out of Shabbos, so then, you know, there is this idea of distancing oneself even from weekday types of thoughts. But so if that's the case, then why is that not the law? I mean, why didn't the Torah say, or why didn't the Chachamim say, and Hirhurim Asurim? Right? They said Chafatzecha Bo Asurim. They said that doing the accounting is not allowed. So why didn't they say Hirhurim Asurim also? Why not? But the Torah says Lo Sachmo, that you shouldn't be jealous of another person's property.
Change your thought.
Yeah, you can change it,
but
you can't stop it.
It comes in. It says, and it says, you know, it's Hashem Elokecha Tira. And it says, Kavides Avicha Vesimecha. All of these things require a person to be able to fine tune their emotions. Why can't the Torah tell us? Right, that's. Because there's a Yisrahara.
24 hours a day. You have a choice either to accept it or not accept it.
So I think that part of the answer is that there's always a cost-benefit ratio. When you demand something of a person, it takes something out of them. Right? Whether it's the energy that's invested, right? Whether it's the time that they're giving up for it, whether it's the guilt that they feel, right? Because there's a learning curve, right? And sometimes it's a very long learning curve, and it's going to engender a lot of guilt before a person, you know, masters it. And for those reasons and others, right, we are very, very careful, right, what we demand of people. If something is absolutely necessary for safety, right, you know, like low tinuf, right, so like there's no room over there. A person cannot, you know, commit, you know, niyuf, because otherwise it's an incredible danger, right, for them and the person that they're involved with. And so there's no room to say, you know, learning curve, guilt, whatever it is, like it's against the rules. But there are other things where the danger level is much lower, and perhaps the learning curve is much longer. And when it comes to those things, so the Torah introduces a certain element of flexibility in order to preserve the optimum spiritual balance. And that, obviously, that's going to vary depending on a person's, you know, emotional intelligence, and depending on a person's, you know, level of religiosity, and depending on a person's, you know, zitzfleisch, and depending on a lot of other psychological factors. And so that you'll end up with some, you know, chassidim for whom perhaps it's appropriate to tell them, you know, herhurim asurim. But we can't make this the law for everybody, right? Because it's something which is likely to result in more detriment than in good. The costs are going to outweigh the, you know, the benefits. And there are many of these sort of escape valves, you know, in the legal system. You know, sometimes we say something is mutter, right? Just that for the select few it's usser, and at other times we'll say something is usser, right? But under select circumstances, it's going to be mutter. And I think that that's where the idea of harama comes in. Harama is certainly not meant to be applied in the pursuit of 21st century Western ideal existence. That's not what harama is meant to be harnessed, you know, towards and is meant to bring a person towards. The idea of the harama is that if for a person who is having the proper, you know, spiritual, you know, balance, right? But sometimes if a person ends up suffering a financial loss, if they're fishnets, right, or they're building, you know, beams, or or their felt pillows, right, or something else, and it'll get ruined, right, because of Shabbos. So that's liable, perhaps, to poison, right, almost, their relationship, to Shabbos. And again, I'm speaking in very extreme terms, but even if it's a little bit attenuated, right, it's not going to poison their relationship, but our relationship to Shabbos is something fragile and something beautiful and something delicate, and it's something that really needs to be cultivated and curated in order to make sure that it really results in the most beautiful and most sturdy and most effective type of result. And so the idea of a harama is sort of like one of these escape valves, so that if a person sees, or if the rabbi sees, that the congregant, that the person asking him the shaila, is in danger, right, of feeling resentful towards Shabbos, or overly resentful, towards Shabbos. So you have this idea of a harama in order to avoid this. So obviously it's going to differ depending on a person's, socioeconomic bracket. A person who's very wealthy and doesn't really care very much for a couple of felt pillows, right, perhaps will not receive the same dispensation to practice this harama as a person for whom these felt pillows are much more important, represent the bigger, share of his, weekly wages, or perhaps they're homemade and they're very, very difficult to come by, or something along those lines. And by the same token, a person whose spiritual struggles are elsewhere, a person who's really, struggling and investing all of his spiritual energy into avoiding malacha, right, into, preserving shalom bias as he moves, towards, religiosity, or a person who's investing, all of his energy into some other sort of major musayun, a person who suffered from some sort of a setback in life and now needs to sort of get his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to find that equilibrium and bring it back onto an even keel, perhaps we'll say, you shouldn't be focusing right now, right, on bringing, Shabbos to a higher level. You have other areas of focus for investing your energy, and so you shouldn't take advantage of this harama, as opposed to a person, right, whose nisayon right now really is in Shmirah Shabbos, a person whose struggles are in terms of malacha, in terms of texting on Shabbos, in terms of taking the opportunity, taking a nap on Erev Shabbos, in terms of interacting, with family, whatever it might be. There are people whose nisyonos are in the area of Shmirat Shabbos, and for those people, we will be much less likely to grant them the dispensation of the harama, because that harama is going to undermine their spiritual avoda rather than free up their energy to devote to it. Right?
They were
on a high level. What that might tell us is that achieving that equilibrium is not something that's easy. If we struggle with it, right? So we can take some comfort from the fact that even Great and Orion, perhaps, were struggled with it, because it's not a level which is easy to achieve, to really make Shabbos, right, into what it was meant for, right? To be like that chassid, who refused to benefit even from the plans that he made in his mind, for Shabbos. To be, there was a holy Jew, right, and I think he was in upstate New York, who used to stay awake for all 25 hours of Shabbos, because he says, how can I waste an hour of the spiritual potential and the insight and the closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how can I waste an hour of that sleeping? But we're not holding there. We climb there. We see that as a goal, perhaps an impassable goal, based on where we are right now, right? But the goal is to keep on pulling ourselves, towards that level. But not, even great people, right, are not that great. I mean to say they're great, right, but they're not. Okay, that's a good way, it's a good way to put it. But again, the idea is that we're supposed to be inspired, by the fact, and not say, I can never be like Rav Mari Baraka. I can never be like Rav. The answer is that yes, Rav. My suspicion is that your standard of living is probably high, well above, Rav's standard of living. Right? But the point is, there is another answer also, which is that sometimes Rabbanim have an achrayos to be lenient, right, which is a little bit counterintuitive. It depends on the community. There are some communities where everybody is lenient, and so then the responsibility of the Rav is to be very, very strict, so hopefully people will follow his example. But there are other communities where people are overly strict and they suffocate themselves, and it's not good for their spirituality. And if that's the case, so then sometimes it's a responsibility of the rabbi to actually go ahead and implement some sort of a lenient, you know, practice, that people can see, right, that this is not, the obligation. My grandmother, Alea Shalom, told me that when she came over from Europe, right, having gone through her teenage years during the Holocaust, so she wasn't 100%, you know, conversant with a lot of things, and so she always used to serve chicken soup on Friday night, and she thought this was a halacha, that you have to serve chicken soup on Friday night. So one time there was a couple of friends who invited, you know, her and my grandfather, Alea Shalom, for the Friday night meal, and served vegetable soup, and my grandmother was astonished, and she said, you're allowed to serve vegetable soup on Friday night? And her hostess said, yeah, you are. And she said, wow, I'm so excited. And from then on, she served vegetable soup on Friday night. And I remember as a kid going to visit her, and she served, it was very yummy vegetable soup with little cut up, carrots and peas and alphabet noodles inside of it. And I still remember, and it came along with this story, right, that, that you're allowed to serve. So like, there might be, a shtickle mitzvah for a rav maybe to serve, vegetable soup on Friday night, once in a while, that people shouldn't feel that in addition, to all of the other, obligations which are chas v'lo yav, are now, in addition to that, they also have to serve chicken soup every Friday night. I like, to tell that Rabbi Soloveitchik, so it's brought down actually in the autobiography of the Bostoner Rebbetzin. So it's brought down a story about Rabbi Soloveitchik, because Rabbi Soloveitchik also lived in Boston. And the story goes that the Bostoner Rebbetzin used to have many, many Shabbos guests, and she would spend until Tuesday or Wednesday washing the china and the silverware, right, from all of her guests. And at a certain point, it was becoming very, very burdensome. She was a very, capable and talented woman who was very involved in the community, and she spent so much time washing dishes. And she was commiserating about this with Rebbetzin Soloveitchik, and Rebbetzin Soloveitchik said that at a certain point, she decided she wanted to go to the Rav's, Motzei Shabbos year. But Motzei Shabbos was dishwashing time, and she wouldn't be able to go to the shir, right, if she was busy washing dishes or if she had these dishes to wash. So she asked the Rav for permission to serve on paper on Shabbos, so that way she wouldn't have to wash dishes, and she could come to the shir. And the Rav said, absolutely. And so Rebbetzin Soloveitchik told the Bostoner Rebbetzin that she serves on paper on Shabbos, and the Bostoner Rebbetzin at that point took on herself also to serve on paper, right? Because again, sometimes you want to free up your energies for a higher level, of... That was the mashmaos of the biography. So there definitely is this idea that perhaps, even if a person wants, right, to do something which is more lekavod Shabbos, but if that's going to be creating a standard for the community which is unreasonably high, so then, the Rav might have a mitzvah to, to bring his conduct, to a level which is appropriate for the community to emulate. So I'll tell you, when I first got married, okay, and I was living in Washington Heights, where most people, didn't use the Eruv at the time, and I was, I was comfortable not using the Eruv, and so I started, bringing my talis to shul, wearing my talis, to shul. And the first Shabbos that I was here, the second Shabbos that I was here, so that I was visiting my parents after getting married, I figured, okay, I'm going to see if I can make this no Eruv thing work. And, I put on my talis and started walking to shul, and my father said to me, the Eruv here is safer. And Like, that was ends it. I folded my towels and I carried it to school from then on. Like, because there's a balance. You know, there might be a certain idea, right, that you want to be machmir for that, you know, bare halacha. But at the same time, right, you have to weigh the costs against the benefits. And sometimes the costs of adapting a chumrah, right, or of neglecting or failing to take advantage of a kula, sometimes those costs will outweigh the benefits. It's the type of thing that a person shouldn't necessarily assess on their own, because, you know, personal bias very often, you know, can get in the way and can distort our judgment. But at the same time, right, there definitely is this idea, right, that there needs to be a cost-benefit analysis. And the Silas Yisharim, I think, articulates this very beautifully in his chapter about, you know, Midas HaChasidus, where he says, why didn't the Torah make Chasidus obligatory for everybody? And his answer was, right, that, you know, that there are so many variables that there would be no way to really specify and delineate all the variables and how they impact upon, right, the decision-making process. And therefore, the Torah suffice to say, Vasisa Yashar Vatov, you know, do what Hashem considers good in business, right? Shabbaton, Shabbos, on Shabbos, you should do things that are consistent with the spirit of Shabbos. When it comes to physical pleasures, it says, Kedoshim Kiyu, you should do things that are consistent with the spirit of the Torah when it comes to, you know, indulgence and deprivation from physical pleasure. And this is a basic, you know, outline, he says, is that there are certain things that are absolutely critical for safety, that you can't go beyond that wall, because otherwise there's a danger of, you know, of dehydration and of wild animals and of bandits. But there are other things which are inside of the wall, and amongst those things, a person has to choose carefully, like, what's appropriate for them on their level. So again, the haramos that we're talking about are not haramos that are meant to be utilized in pursuit, right, of 21st century, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The haramos here are escape valves. So if the pressure, right, of... Oh, we don't do that anymore?
What?
I thought that the pursuit of happiness only intensified as time went on. But again, the basic idea is that, like we saw that the Rambam acknowledges that Shabbos can sometimes be boring, and it's something that we need to take into account. And I quoted, you know, a number of times in the Keves HaMishnah, who says that we're aware, right, that sometimes by overdoing the regulations of Shabbos, that can lead to a shvisa shel tzar. It can lead to the menucha turning into, you know, pain, right, and negative feelings and resentment towards Shabbos. And the Chachamim, the legislature that originally made the halachos and muktzah, right, tried to balance everything, right, but when they balanced everything, they were balancing it for all Jews, right, over all the centuries. And over all the countries where they lived, which included a very, very wide range, right, of, you know, levels of religiosity, of, you know, financial, you know, class and stuff like that. And so what they did was, is that they made a set of laws, which was the best laws overall for all of their constituents and all of the citizens, right, of the, you know, Jewish civilization. But at the same time, because there needs to be a certain measure of flexibility to fine tune, right, the halachos to best fit with the spiritual, you know, state and level and ambitions and direction of each individual community. So they needed to build in certain, you know, loopholes or pressure release valves. And that's what the haramos are meant to serve as. Again, like Rav Kook said, it's in order to bring the letter of the law in line with the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law is not that people should feel resentful towards Shabbos. The spirit of the law is that people should feel, you know, happy and fulfilled through the medium of Shabbos. And the haramos are designed in order to enable that to happen. If a person needs a little bit, you know, of a break, if they shouldn't lose their felt pillows or their fishnets or whatever it might be, so that's really where the haramos, you know, come in. Now again, it's really hard to know, right, when a person asks the shayla, right? So are they a person who are struggling with Shira Shabbos, in which case they should get, you know, perhaps a more, you know, more lenient, you know, psak, so they shouldn't feel that resentment? Or are they a person whose energies, you know, are meant to go in other directions? And that's why it's important for everybody to have a Rav who knows his personal circumstances, who knows his personal struggles, someone who you're in touch with on a regular basis to update about, you know, what your shilos are and what, you know, what your challenges are, what your successes are, like what you're working with. And that way you'll have the information to sort of help guide you along and along the path which is most optimum. No, I don't think that's what's used.
They take out a pen or whatever they have in their pocket, they give it to him.
That's
what
I'm saying.
This
guy
takes out his phone. You can keep it.
Yeah,
of course you can keep it.
Try walking out with it.
Yeah, they usually say, I'm giving you my phone and you have to, I'm an Apple answer.
I never really wrote the email card. Just take my pen and
so again, when it comes to Kabbalah's Kinyan, there's Kinyan Chalifin is something unique. It's, you know, the Rav, you know, Rav Shachter says every year and a half the Rav would say this Vart, right? That there are some Kinyanim that are done by physical action, and there are some Kinyanim which really lie primarily in the mind, he said. And the Kinyan Chalifin is primarily in the mind, and the action is simply just like a rubber stamp, you know, if you will, or something that's done, you know, lechazik es ha'inyan. And so the idea here is the kinyan chalipin, right? When you're transferring, the shlichos, right? Ideally, it's not even a kinyan chalipin. And what you're doing is you're appointing the rod as your shliach, like you tell the chamid. And in order to strengthen that dibur, so we accompany it with a maisa. So the maisa happens to be a kabbalah, kinyan that strengthens the minoy shlichos. And we're talking about really dibur alone is enough to create the shlichos. We're strengthening it. We try to strengthen it with the kinyan. So if you're doing the kinyan with the matan amenasahasi, I'm not really sure that detracts too much from the purpose over there. If you're talking about like a real, to sell the chametz to the guy, I don't think that we would use matan amenasahasi. There, the mechanisms are much more rigorous. Does it work? I think it's a whole sugya. Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the outcome was, but it is a discussion. And as you said, by Lulav and Esther, it applies as well. So, again, the same thing, Hefer Mechira, so when people, literally died of starvation, as they did back in the late, 1800s, so, because the first settlers who came to Israel tried to keep Mechira, and people died of starvation and of disease, and malnutrition, and that was, sort of what galvanized, right, the group of Rabbanim to reassess their hesitancy to rely on the Hefer of the Beis Yosef, for Hefer Mechira. But again, there are big questions about whether those same Rabbanim, were they alive nowadays, would say the same thing. You could talk about, what percentage of Israel's, crops are grown for export, and what's the risk, how much of the gross domestic, I forget what the fancy term is at risk if you cut off your contracts with European, buyers and foreign buyers for a year, and how many of them, will go elsewhere, and how many of them will come back. And again, if you had the majority of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, and Shemitah was the Araita, and we had the bracha of the Asas, if the 6 year old make three, there's no shaila at all, right? Everybody would keep it because there's absolutely no need, for the harama. But again, considering that there's a certain spirit of Shemitah, so the Hefer Mechira might be something which is justified as long as it brings the letter of the law in line, right, with the spirit of the law. Again, Mechira es chametz, when you're talking about, business, how do you want the businessman to feel, right, about Pesach? Do you want him to starve because of Pesach? Do you want him to lower his standard of living, for the entire year? Do you want him to quit his job and to take another job? Not so easy back in Europe where most, people were here, somehow involved in beer production. And so again, in order to deal with the exigencies that were prevalent in that particular place and in that particular time, so Chazal and Halacha built in the opportunity for these haramos. But the haramos are not meant to be taken advantage of in the broader context. The Vilna Gaon, now coming back to Boaz's story, the Vilna Gaon was very against Hefer Iskas. And again, the question is, when is a Hefer Iska meant to be utilized? It's meant to be utilized when you have a person and they're trying to start a business and they can't start the business because they don't have capital. But people are not willing, to free up the capital because they could lend the capital to Goyim with interest, or they could invest it themselves, with interest. And so it's not right, to ask them, to give a significant portion of their of their revenue producing, assets to somebody else in a way that doesn't produce the revenue. I had a story that there was a loan that was, you know, very, very important to a particular community, and there was a couple, you know, a retired couple who stepped forward, and they said that they're willing to take out a good chunk of their life savings, right, from whichever, you know, retirement account the life savings were in, and put it towards the loan. But they said, like, this is really, you know, what's generating interest that we're counting on, you know, to keep us going, you know, over the years. And we feel that it's only right that the community should pay us, you know, if not, you know, the level of interest that we're earning, at least, you know, something. And, you know, and that's the type of situation where, like, will they do it if they can't get the interest? Do they have to do it? Do we want them to feel that they're being, you know, taken advantage of? And again, it's hard to know. It may depend on their, you know, level of religiosity. When I ask them, they're willing, it's like, yeah, just tell them to give it as an interest-free loan. Right? But I'm not sure if you kind of got the full situation in that case. I didn't go through all the details, but this was a retired couple who was basically giving, you know, 80% of their life savings, to the community as a loan, and they're asking back, like, the lowest level of interest that they could possibly earn from it. So that might be the type of situation that where a Heter Iska would be desirable, again, depending on the people's situation. But if you're dealing with a smaller situation, so then, you know, maybe not. You know, mortgages on a house, right? So if you have a co-signer on the mortgage, right, and, you know, so sometimes there you have to sign a Heter Iska, not necessarily because, I forget exactly all the details, but there is Heter Iska when somebody co-signs on a mortgage. And again, that's a type of situation where, like, what's going to happen otherwise? The person's not going to be able to buy the house, right? Like, that was Kruzbol. Hillel HaZaken did Kruzbol, which is another example, right, of a, you know, of a harama, which was meant to address, right, the needs of the time. And the reason that we still do Kruzbol nowadays is because we're nervous that maybe that if we don't do a Kruzbol, we'll end up violating, right, the halachos of Shmitas Ksafim. And in order to, like, rescue ourselves from every chance, right, of possibly, you know, violating the halacha, so we write, you know, Kruzbol. But, you know, again, in its original context, it was done to promote to promote people giving loans so that more people can have jobs, and we felt that justified perhaps the harama, because again the ultimate goal is a balanced, you know, and healthy and productive and uplifting and fulfilling spiritual existence. And so again, if yesterday's shiur, right, sort of like, you know, is like looking, you know, gloatingly almost at the opportunities, you know, for haramos, that was not the intention. Harama is only meant to, you know, to be utilized, right, in a context which enhances the spirit of the law. It's never meant to be utilized by people, and never meant even for Rabbanim to give the heter in a context which takes away, right, and weakens the spirit of the law. And again, that's why it's so important not to make these decisions by ourselves, and in fact to find somebody knowledgeable in halacha, in the application of halacha, and in Torah Shkafa, who also knows our particular situation, so that the heterim can be given when they're deserved and not withheld, and at the same time so that the heterim can be withheld when they ought to be withheld and not just given indiscriminately.
The only thing that I can understand is the Ishidra. And the clearest for me is that a Rabbunim created thing. So it's a Rabbunim gets this Torah, and who writes it and out, it's a lot of stress.
Okay, so try not to do it. Okay.
So, yeah.